Non-governmental think tank Levada Center states that Russians identified India as one of their top five friends, with the others being Belarus, China, Kazakhstan, and Syria.
There have been substantial shifts in the geopolitical dynamics of global powers in recent years, with differences deepening between the US and China and the US and Russia. This is while Sino-Russian ties are, in Lavrov's words, the highest in history, and China and India are well set to become economic powerhouses before mid-century, thus playing significant strategic roles in their regions and beyond. Therefore, the United States needs new policies to balance Russia's closer connections to Pakistan and India. Lavrov was unable to meet Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Delhi because the latter was campaigning in West Bengal, although John Kerry, the U.S. presidential envoy, did manage a meeting the following day. During the joint presser with Lavrov, Jaishankar's mind was so preoccupied with Washington's reaction that when he was describing the cordial nature of the relationship, he said India-US instead of India-Russia.
...of India-US relations.
Now, to learn more about the Russian foreign minister's visit to India and Pakistan, we are joined by Mr. Mark Sloboda. He's the international relations and security analyst. Mr. Sloboda, welcome to the show. So, what is the significance of Lavrov's visit to the subcontinent?
Okay, so Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's visit to India and then to Pakistan has been primarily billed as an attempt to reset Russian-Indian relations after there is some indication that in the last few years they have moved farther and farther apart. There is an annual Russian-Indian summit that is usually held. The summit was canceled last year, ostensibly because of the coronavirus crisis, which does make a certain amount of sense. But there's also a lot of talk, particularly in Moscow, that the Kremlin was not looking forward to the meeting anyway and was happy to cancel it to signal its displeasure at the Indian moving strategically into cooperation with the Quad, with the United States, directed against China, whatever they India may make denials about, and this Indo-Pacific policy. Russia regards this as a attempt to form an Asian NATO, and that the grouping not only threatens China, which is Russia's strong strategic partner now, but also the Russian position in the Pacific as well. So this meeting was an attempt to, I would say, rather than reset, to manage a minimum amount of maintenance to the Russian-Indian relationship. But the two have moved quite far apart in the last 4 or 5 years. In 2014, when Modi first came to office, he was quite famously asked about the relationship, and he said that if he asked any Indian child which country is the greatest friend of India, and that it would be Russia, because they have been to, Russia has always been there in times of crisis for India.
Okay, so how is the current status of India-Russia ties? Did Lavrov's India trip reset the ties to a better direction? Does Lavrov's trip mean anything really in terms of the dynamics of Russia's relations with India?
Yeah, I don't think that there is any positive change because of Lavrov's trip to India. In fact, Lavrov was unable, presumably, to meet with the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, supposedly because he was campaigning in West Bengal. And Lavrov met instead only with his counterpart, the Indian Foreign Minister. However, the very next day, the U.S.'s special, President Biden's special climate envoy, John Kerry, who was formerly the U.S. Secretary of State under Obama, he did meet with Modi. So that is makes clear the priorities, strategic priorities of India's prime minister in this situation. Whereas when Lavrov then went to Pakistan, he met with both the Pakistani defense minister and the Pakistani prime minister Khan. That is Islamabad clearly signaling that Russia is higher in their priority than Russia is for India. And that's not a good indication.
How would these visits impact India-U.S. relationship? How would the United States see and react to such developments?
I think the United States will look very favorably on the outcome of Lavrov's visit to India, the awkwardness that was clear, the failure to make any kind of breakthrough, and even the failure of Lavrov to meet with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. There has been some suggestion that the U.S. demanded of India that they do not allow a meeting between their prime minister and the Russian foreign minister. That is, purely speculation. But there is no question that the United States has ever increasing influence on India, and that India is being incredibly receptive to that influence. While Lavrov was there, the Indian foreign minister made clear to say that it regards it is looking for inclusive cooperation, and it is not directed against anyone, and that its relationships with Russia are not dependent on, or Russia or any other country are not dependent on its relations with any third country. Well, that is clearly false. That is a false statement, because quite definitely, India's relationships with other countries is now determined by what the United States wants and dictates. One clear example of that is that India, which was a major purchaser of Iranian oil in mid-2019 at the demands of the United States, stopped purchasing Iranian oil because of the U.S. Trump administration's unilateral illegal sanctions imposed on Iran as the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So that's India quite clearly working against its own energy interests and energy security, a long relationship with Iran at the demands of the United States.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sriboda, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. Let's take a quick look at how people on social media and cyberspace have reacted to this development. Please stay with us.
Riaz Haq has wrapped up all the important feats of the Russian foreign minister to the subcontinent. Nutan Nihar has highlighted the role of the West in Moscow's ties with India. Ahmed Qureshi has pointed out that Afghanistan is a converging issue where all of the involved countries are working together. Akhtar Navid Sayed has responded to another post noting that the United States is the only player in Afghanistan that is not from the region. He says Washington is the imperialist in this game. Bilal Ahmed Ghaffar has elaborated on the Russian blank check for India, citing gas pipelines, corridors and defense cooperation as some areas of interest.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Islamabad has banned Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan amid violent anti-France protests by the far-right party. Although this group has terrorized religious minorities in Pakistan, including Shias, by the way, over bogus charges of blasphemy, its demand of boycotting French products and expelling the French envoy is not totally unwarranted. After all, it is the French Islamophobia that is fueling this anger and outrage across the country as well as the world.
Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or TLP, is an extremist group with a history of atrocities on religious minorities within the country. However, the group was not banned until mid-April in the midst of large and violent protests against France. Despite the government's measures under the country's Anti-Terrorism Act of 1997, the group threatened further demonstrations if Islamabad did not comply with its demands. Since November, the group has been calling for the expulsion of the French ambassador and a ban on all French goods over repeated incidents of blasphemous sacrilegious remarks against Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. Earlier in the month, police arrested TLP chief Saad Rizvi, the son of party founder Khadim Hussein Rizvi, who died of natural causes shortly after the November protests. The arrest sparked days of unrest, with thousands of TLP supporters launching protests and blocking roads and highways across the country. The protests by the TLP continued in pockets across the country last week, with Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid confirming that several policemen had been killed and kidnapped, while hundreds of others were wounded by demonstrators.
The Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan came into existence and subsequently rose to fame after the hanging of Mumtaz Qadri, the person who killed Punjab Governor Salman Taseer. Masses of TLP supporters came in support of Mumtaz Qadri, calling him a fallen hero instead of a killer. The group, whose members mainly belong to the Bareilvi School of Islamic Thought, is known for its countrywide street power and massive protests in opposition to change to Pakistan's blasphemy law.
11B
The Pakistani government declared Tehreek-e-Labbaik a terrorist organization and carried out a couple of security operations against its protesting followers, but the group is not willing to settle down on anything short of expulsion of French ambassador. The rallies are going on somehow unabated, while the public outrage against the French acts of sacrilege has given a stronger footing to the TLP. The government of Imran Khan is now weighing its choices to handle the situation, while the anti-France sentiments are still on the rise in Pakistan. The government has resumed negotiations with the TLP, but it seems to be running out of options but to rescind the ban on the activities of this political and religious outfit.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Muzammil Maqbool. He's the founder of Rumi Center for Global Peace. Mr. Maqbool, starting off, why has Islamabad banned Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan? What is this group and what do they want? What is the cause of the recent violent protests in Pakistan?
Islamabad banned TLP recently, and there were a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, the reason is that in this Islamist group is, you know, trying to intervene in the matters of the federal government. You know, they are trying to tame the government in a lot of issues. For example, when Charlie Hebdo cartoons were published, the government promised this party that, you know, they will take this matter internationally and they will make sure that these issues should be raised, issues like Islamophobia, racial slurs and issues against the article of faith about our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But then, you know, they started intervening into government matters, taming the government, telling them that, you know, giving them ultimatums, which is actually wrong. So we are not dealing with Ummah, we are dealing with a nation, a sovereign nation like Pakistan. And in a nation, if you will tame a federal government and tell them what to do and what not to do, creates a lot of problems. So this compelled Ministry of Interior Affairs and Ministry of Home Affairs to go ahead and ban this organization under the Terrorist Act. This organization is nothing but the hardcore Islamist organization who believes that, you know, Sharia law, the hardcore Sharia law, should be implemented across the nation, across Pakistan, and they have always been anti minority when it comes to Shias, when it comes to Hazaras, when it comes to Ahmadis in Pakistan. And they sort of have created a paradigm in minds of people across the world, that especially in Pakistan, that these are the only people who love Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And they try to create or present a narrative of Islam which is totally wrong. You know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is Prophet for you, Prophet for me and everyone else. He has been a merciful man ever sent to this entire universe by Almighty Allah. So this is what it is, and our Prophet Muhammad is Rahmatul Alameen for everyone. But the narrative they set is that, you know, they only know how to love Prophet, how to show love for Prophet, and how to handle Islam is totally wrong. So this actually made the entire federal government to go ahead and ban this entire TLP, Tehreek-e-Labbaik, Pakistan.
What can Pakistan do about nationwide protests against diplomats or authorities of another country? In this case, France.
Nationwide protests. You know, Pakistan tried to do a lot of things, you know, before these protests, before the TLP hit the streets. So they spoke with them in the month of November, December, January, and February as well. And they promised TLP, Khan's government promised TLP that, you know, they would discuss this entire issue in Parliament. But before that, TLP were openly and covertly trying to, you know, plan to hit the streets of Islamabad and occupy every street, lane and road. Pakistan tried their best to make sure that, you know, they will try to bridge the gap in between TLP and the federal government, but things could not work out. That is the reason, you know, they banned them. But then there has been discussions by the federal government, you know, with TLP to stop these protests. The best thing federal government can do right now to reach other people of the TLP, like there are other spokespersons, there is Amir and the, you know, a deputy Amir of TLP. They can reach other people and try to break down things slowly. This is what can happen. And secondly, as I was going through the speech of, you know, Imran Khan today, he promised that he will raise the Islamic phobia issue around the world and make sure that, you know, all the countries around the world will stop playing with the emotions, stop playing on the article of faith, which is related to our religion and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and will make sure that, you know, it should not happen again. And he also promised the entire nation that, you know, he wants other OIC members, you know, 50 plus odd countries who are in OIC, he wants them to intervene in this issue and make sure that, you know, it should get stopped once for all. Like the Holocaust thing happened, and, you know, no one talks about that. And even in many countries, you know, it's banned. People get jailed if they talk about Holocaust. So these things, you know, the Pakistan government has to be preempt on this and give a lot of assurance right now to these leaders and the deputy leaders, Amirs of this TLP, and make sure that, you know, things should settle down as soon as possible. And at the same time, you know, there is a lot of work and a lot of machinery work which Pakistan government have to start as soon as possible. And they have to speak with these spokespersons, with these main founding members of TLP who have founded this in 2016, and make sure that things should settle down as soon as possible. As a sovereign nation, Pakistan has to go ahead and make sure that, you know, they will break the communication barrier, which is getting bigger and bigger every minute passing by.
All right, that marks the end of this session. Thank you so much, Mr. Baqbool, for being with us. Now, let's see what people have said online about TLP and the protests in Pakistan.
Ruhan Ahmed has shared the list of banned groups in which the TLP has been added. The Defense 360 account has talked about the government's inability to handle the pro-TLP protests, saying that Pakistan's elite forces have been deployed across the country to control the rallies. Imar Khan has underlined that Pakistan's religious scholars have never condoned the protests by the TLP and its followers. Hina Qureshi says the protests were aggravated following the arrest of the extremist group's young leader.
All right, that was our episode about some latest developments across the subcontinent, from the Russian foreign minister visit to India and Pakistan, as well as the violent anti-France protests throughout Pakistan. We will meet next week. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Austin's personal history and connection to the military and Raytheon mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., says Jeremy Kosmarov, writer, in an article titled U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has awarded over $2.36 billion in contracts to Raytheon since his confirmation in January. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. The Pentagon has awarded the defense giant Raytheon Technologies over $2.36 billion in government contracts since Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin confirmation on January 22nd. Austin was on Raytheon's board of directors prior to his confirmation. Austin at the time had made a commitment to resign from Raytheon's board and rescue himself from all matters concerning Raytheon for 4 years and agreed to divest from his financial holdings in a company, amounting to between $500,000 and $1.7 million in stock. These initiatives, however, have not prevented Austin from using his position to bolster Raytheon's fortunes. Nor those of other defense contractors on whose board he has sat, such as Booz Allen Hamilton, the world's most profitable spy organization, according to Bloomberg News, and Pine Island Capital, a private equity firm that invests in military industry. At Austin's nomination hearing, Senator Elizabeth Warren questioned him about his ties to Raytheon, whose headquarters are based in Warren's home district of Walton, Massachusetts. A year earlier, Warren had proposed legal changes to strengthen ethics at the Defense Department by blocking the revolving door between the Pentagon and giant defense contractors like Raytheon, including by prohibiting big defense contractors from hiring former Pentagon officials for 4 years after they leave government. Warren paradoxically voted to confirm Austin's appointment as defense secretary, even though he embodies the danger of the revolving door. Mark Pocan, who with Barbara Lee wrote a letter in November 2020 to President-elect Joe Biden requesting that he nominate a Secretary of Defense with no previous ties to weapons manufacturers, stated that American national security should not be defined by the bottom lines of Boeing, General Dynamics, and Raytheon. With men like Austin at the helm, however, it is very clearly being defined in this way. Reporting revenues of more than $97.5 billion in 2020, Raytheon began its corporate life in 2020 as the American appliance company developing refrigerators and radio parts and making advances in vacuum tube technology and related electronics. The company was drawn into military contracting during the Second World War when it manufactured magnetron tubes for use in radar systems. One of the company's founders, Vannevar Bush, became president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and chairman of the U.S. Office of Scientific Research and Development, or SRD, during the Second World War, which initiated the Manhattan Project that led to the development of the atomic bomb. In 2003, Raytheon put out a press release bragging that half of all air-to-ground precision-guided missiles, PGMs, used by coalition forces in Operation Iraqi Freedom were made by Raytheon. Raytheon was also the first major defense contractor to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, selling the kingdom over 1,000 cluster bombs designed to maximize civilian casualties between 1970 and 1995. The company further hired members of the Saudi royal family as consultants and opened a branch in Riyadh in 2017. After the Yemen war began in 2015, Raytheon, according to an analysis by the New York Times, booked more than $3 billion in new bomb sales to the Saudis, causing its stock prices to increase from about $108 to more than $180 per share. In 2019, Raytheon sold an estimated $8 billion in weapons to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which are centrally involved in the war in Yemen. After an October 2016 Saudi airstrike on a funeral home in Sana'a that killed 140 people and wounded 500 more, human rights workers discovered the bomb shared bearing the identification number of Raytheon. It was one of at least 12 attacks on civilians that human rights groups tied to Raytheon's ordinance during the first 2 years of the war. In order to secure the lucrative Saudi deals, Raytheon took the advantage of the federal loopholes by sending former State Department officials to lobby their former colleagues, and later benefited by having their former top lobbyist, Mark Esper, appointed as Defense Secretary in June 2019 in a precursor to General Austin's hiring. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, a left-wing think tank, told The Intercept that since Raytheon manufactures the bomb components that are used in Yemen, General Austin bears a direct responsibility for war crimes and civilian death. He was making money as a board member of this company that is directly responsible for the death and destruction there. William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Project for the Center for International Policy, said that picking Austin was tantamount to making the position of Secretary of Defense the Secretary of Defense contractors. Fitting with Hartung's assessment, Raytheon has benefited from multi-million dollar government contracts on a near-daily basis since Austin has taken charge at the Pentagon. On February 1st, the company secured a whopping $290,704,534 government contract to produce equipment for depot maintenance facilities and services in support of the F-35 Lightning II, which military analyst Pierre Spray characterized as overweight and dangerous. Spray stated that it's as if Detroit suddenly put out a car with lighter fluid in the radiator and gasoline in the hydraulic brake lines. That's how unsafe this plane is and full of bugs. On March 26, Raytheon received another huge contract valued at $518,443,821 to produce advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, which have been credited with air-to-air kills in conflicts over Iraq, Bosnia, Kashmir, and Syria. On February 26, Raytheon was awarded an $18,662,845 contract to provide support services for a Javelin anti-tank weapon system, which has been provided to Ukraine for use against Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine. On the same day, Raytheon was awarded a $32,853,210 contract for autonomous swarm strike loitering munitions, also known as suicide drones, which can be launched from unmanned surface and underwater vessels.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahlai. Just a couple of weeks ago, we covered the 10-year war anniversary of the war on Syria. Now it's time to cover another brutal U.S.-backed war, and that is the war on Yemen. It is now 6 years old. This is what Yemen's economy looked like before the war. From the year 2000, we took a look up until the year 2018. As you can see, the economy was actually not doing that bad. It had a GDP growth of between 6 to 8%, but you can see the dip there. That is when the war broke out, roughly around the year 2014, and it went all the way down to minus 28%. Pretty bad. I mean, this actually is a brutal war. Bombs are doing the killing on both the civilians and the economy. But the country itself actually, before the war began, was not doing well. It was a poor country. Living on less than $2 a day accounted for 45% of the population, 33% living on less than $1 a day. So you can see that this country was affected deeply by poverty. Okay, it is no surprise then that this kind of devastation, the war that the country has been inflicted on the country, well, there are many aspects of the economy that have grinded to a halt as a result. One common denominator that reflects the dire straits of the economy is the collapse of the Yemeni rial. The focus of our next report.
Cashiers sort through large stacks of money. Yemen's central bank has become another front line in this war. The bank's headquarters was moved from the capital Sana'a in the year 2016. The government not recognized by the Yemenis accused the legitimate government of Yemen, the National Salvation Government, that it was using its resources to finance the war. But this was just another effort by the Saudis and its allies to squeeze the Yemenis. The relocation of the bank made the situation worse, since it divided the country. As one analyst put it, it left the country with two parallel centers of fiscal policy dealing with one currency.
Time to begin our first guest of today's show. Her name is Judith Brown, and she is a former manager at UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She was the manager at Refugee Health Project in Yemen until the year 2001, and she also has a Facebook page on Yemen, which is good to see. Judith, welcome. The destruction of Yemen is something that is truly devastating and shocking. When we take a look at the way that the Saudi bombing campaign has happened for 6 years, I mean, this country was a poor country to begin with, and you have an economy that's in tatters, and the bombing campaign is said to have targeted vital infrastructure, which is my focus on this question, roads and hospitals, for example. Was that done with the aim of actually destroying the economy so that the people would rise up against the National Salvation Government there, do you think?
I think that one has to say that the Yemen economy has been targeted in many ways from the beginning, not only by bombing campaign, but by the embargo, by the movement of banks, by restriction of money in North Yemen. And yes, it has. In fact, I think one of the things that you didn't mention is its particular attack on the agricultural industry, everything to do with it, markets, farms, animal livestock, warehouses, factories that produce food. They've all been targeted by the Saudi campaign, and that's been quite well documented. And certainly it has had the result of Yemen's economy being totally destroyed. I think that, was it on purpose? I think my own feeling is that that was a target, because I think that modern warfare doesn't aim to necessarily win wars, but to destroy companies and keep those countries in a perpetual state of war.
Indeed, that could be the case. Thank you, Judith. We're going to definitely come back to you a little later in this program. Well, it's time to take a look at our second report of this program, which takes a look at one of the consequences of this war, food insecurity, and its impact on the national economy.
A hungry child, malnourished due to prolonged lack of food. Shortages of water.
Central bank is out of money. The price of the basic food basket, the things you need as a family in order to survive, has increased by 30% in just the past few weeks alone, and it's continuing to increase. These are the same sets of factors that drove the country to the brink of famine 18 months ago.
The world has failed the Yemeni people.
Now, to seize this chance to revitalize the political process that we now hope we can see in front of us.
But the will of the Yemenis is still there as they welcome the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a residents said they gave the Muslim holy month a great reception. People have flocked to the supermarkets for their Ramadan needs. However, not all Yemenis are as lucky, as in the legitimate capital Sana'a, run by the National Salvation Government. Yemenis see them as the legitimate governing body of the country. They have pledged a commitment to them.
Our guest for this section is Mia Shua. She earned her PhD in political economy from the University of Sydney and has written many articles, one of them titled Revisiting Neoliberalism and Democracy in a Time of Crisis. Mia, welcome to the program. Yemen is said to be so broken that it can never be put back together again. Take the Yemen Central Bank, for example, split into two by the self-proclaimed president of Yemen, Abra Matsahadi. That's resulted in trades at one rate in the National Salvation Government-controlled capital like Sana'a, and then another rate in SCC-controlled Aden. That's the Southern Transitional Council. Basically, this seems to be an effort to break the country into two parts. Is that what the aim is?
The fragmentation of state institutions is an unfortunate but expected outcome of this ruthless war. You could argue that the government's efforts to hold on to power and suffocate the Houthi movement at all costs has perpetuated this fragmentation and intensified it. The relocation of the bank is part of a government plan to bring the banking system in Yemen under its control and deprive the Houthis of millions of dollars acquired from taxes from Sana'a-based banks and mobile operators. The president's move sparked an economic war between the two banks, as the Houthis refused to pay salaries of public servants in areas under their control and banned banknotes printed by the Yemeni government in Aden. It was said that the cuts in salaries had a severe economic toll. However, despite the Yemeni government efforts to control the exchange system, the Yemeni rial on Thursday moved towards a new record low in the government-controlled areas.
Okay, thank you, Mia. That's Mia Shua with her thoughts there. It's time to take a break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are.
Yeah.
Let's welcome back guest Judith Brown, the former manager at UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Judith, we're going to take a look at Report City of Aden and my question here, which is under Saudi Emirati siege, not letting the flow of goods freely into the country. The Saudis and its allies, they are not capable of winning this war. Why don't they settle for a political solution instead of destroying the country, placing a siege on Aden, and continuing this war in which they are not only losing, but they're choking the economy as a result?
Well, I think that one of the things is that powers outside Yemen don't seem to want Yemen to end the war. Certainly, I think that when Trump was in power, he saw the possibility of selling a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Biden came in making a great grand statement that he was going to return Yemen to peace, but in fact has done absolutely nothing except return the situation back to the same situation as Obama, i.e. he's not selling precision weapons, and he's talking about ceasefires, he's talking about peace talks, none of which have happened, and I can't see that they're going to happen. I know that a lot of people in the north of Yemen, they say to me that this is a proxy war, in as much as Saudi Arabia is fighting on behalf of UK and USA. I think there's a lot of truth in that, in as much as I think that the powers outside Yemen seem to have their own interests in keeping wars going across the whole of the Middle East. And keeping those countries destabilized for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but instability is a feature of war at the moment, wars without end that seem to go on forever, and I don't think that that the situation is one where there seems to be any urgency in the Biden camp, apart from making a statement, one of his first statements that he made when he first came to office. There doesn't seem to be any urgency in him implementing anything that's likely to create peace. And of course, ironically, one of the ways that you could stop outside parties from interfering in Yemen is by stopping the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia and UAE that are perpetuating the war in Yemen.
All right, that's Judith Brown there with her thoughts. Now let's go to the port city of Aden, which I mentioned, and see how Yemenis are actually faring there, because Aden is a port city. It should be doing okay, but the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed an embargo on that city.
The port city of Aden, key in the distribution of goods to the entire country. Maybe one reason why the UAE and Saudi Arabia placed a blockade on the country. Even that coalition failed, called a war within a war. A reported five-fold spike in deaths started the year 2021. Reasons? From COVID-19 to a variety of diseases, including hunger and cholera. This is one way Yemenis are making a living, transporting goods through donkeys. But food shortages, a sharp appreciation of the currency, and a lack of funds to pay public sector employees have plagued the port city.
It's time now for an in-depth section of this program. We're going to take a look at the numbers coming out of war-battered Yemen, which couldn't be more shocking, really. First, let's take a look at the population in that country. This is not a shock. The population has risen to 29.16 million, a little less than 30 million. Of course, there's been 300, 400, 500,000 maybe to have been killed as a result of the war. Now, in terms of the number of Yemenis that need urgent help, that amounts to 9.8 million, a little less than 10 million. Obviously, many Yemenis need basic health care, something that they can't have access to because of the bombing campaign that's happening. That number is 14.8 million people. That's almost half of the population, to put that into context for you. Now, as of April 12th, this is what Martin Griffiths, the UN special envoy for the country, has said, practically begging for the warring parties to seize opportunity for peace in the country.
The war in Yemen has lasted over 6 years. In these 6 years, Yemenis have increasingly and appallingly lacked access to food and medicine. More than 6 years with no basic services, with restriction of movement in and around and out of the country, and over 6 years of the children of Yemen being deprived of schooling and being deprived of their future. A generation has been lost.
Yeah, a generation lost indeed. Of course, you may be lost as a result of all the numbers that we are throwing at you. So let's do this. I want to put things into context for you and tell you, what if Yemen was 100 people? 100 people. And out of that, give you numbers out of 100 people as to the situation in Yemen. For example, the first item that we're going to take a look at would be humanitarian assistance, to make it simple. Out of each 100 people in Yemen, 74 would need humanitarian aid out of 100 people. Moving now next to having no access to clean water or sanitation services. The number of people that are in need of that are 57 out of 100. So you can see how severe these numbers are. Now, the next item that we're going to take a look at are people in Yemen who are food insecure and are at risk of famine. Here the number stands at 60 out of every 100 person in Yemen. Of course, these numbers, again, are very shocking, to put things into context for you. The next number is another shocking number when it comes to women. 10 of the women and children in Yemen are acutely malnourished. These numbers, such as this one, could actually now be more because the war is still ongoing. And finally, we're going to take a look at the figure that drove home the devastation of this war. You heard of the phrase in Yemen, how a child dies every 10 minutes. Why is a child dying every 10 minutes? The reason cited: malnutrition, diarrhea, and breathing infections. Now, does that give you a better idea? I hope so. Well, here is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric on his latest look at the grave economic and humanitarian situation in that country.
Moving on to Yemen, our colleagues there tell us that the humanitarian situation continues to worsen, with fuel and food prices at double or even triple the pre-conflict averages, and the depreciation of the Yemeni rial, the threat of hunger for millions, is a reality.
Stefan Dujarric there, the U.S. spokesperson, who took a look at the grave economic situation in that country, not to mention, of course, the humanitarian situation. Now, we're going to bring in Mia Shua to get an analysis on that. Mia, welcome back. You are aware of the importance of Aden. So has Saudi Arabia and the UAE. They've set up a legitimate government there in their eyes. And we know that Aden is very important because most, if not all, goods that come through the country have to get distributed from there. But it's placed under a siege. What is your assessment of the situation of Aden and the embargo that both the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed there?
Yes, Saudi and its allies have the budget and the will to continue their campaign against a politically and economically independent Yemen. Aside from this, there is also the issue of Yemen's position at the gate of the Red Sea, a channel for Saudi exports and trade. Saudi is threatened by the idea of having a potentially powerful state on their southern border and controlling, maybe even policing, the Red Sea. This scenario would see Yemen carry a lot of leverage against their current aggressor. From this perspective, the Saudi coalition may prefer to continue their brutal campaign rather than face this difficult outcome of Yemeni control in the Red Sea.
Okay, thank you, Mia, for that. We do appreciate that. Now, we can cover the humanitarian figures of this war at length, but we also need to get a feel of some of the economic indicators, which also show how bad the economy is doing. Now, let's first take a look at how much money the country has lost in terms of its oil revenues. $75 billion is the figure that we have as of the latest figure for the loss of oil revenue. That figure, again, could be higher. The GDP is the next item. The cumulative GDP percentage contraction in real GDP terms came in at a whopping minus 50% for the year 2020. So half of the country's GDP to have been lost there. What does all of this translate into when it comes to economic loss as a whole? That's $88.8 billion. war in Yemen has battered the economy there for 6 years, and it doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. What has fueled this war has been weapons, military equipment, sold mainly by the U.S. to Saudi Arabia and its allies. That has kept the war going on for 6 years now. But did you ever wonder why the war continues, even though Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to lose on the ground, like multiple attacks by the Yemeni army on Saudi's moneymaker Aramco and other military advances by the Yemeni army? Well, the reason is simple. Saudi Arabia is losing the war. It's spending a lot of money at it, too. And the Yemeni army wants to have a strong hand when it comes to the negotiations. That is why the Yemeni army is fighting to capture Ma'arib. That is the biggest district by area. Don't forget, the Saudis just recently offered a peace plan. It was rejected by the National Salvation Government because, well, it did not put an end to the blockade, which was a key demand of the government. U.S. support, once it ends, will wrap up the war. No doubt about that. But the question is there a strong enough will by the U.S. to give its order to Saudi Arabia to end the war? That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitali, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Brussels has encouraged European Union member states to act on a new European Medicines Agency opinion that the benefits of the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine outweighs the risk of blood clots in all adult age groups. The European Commissioner for Health, Stella Kyriakides, emphasized the vaccine's importance as part of the European Union's strategy despite months of controversy following the latest conclusions from the European Medicines Agency, EMA. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Daniel Buffy and Sarah Bosley. The piece is titled, EU Urges Member States to Re-embrace AstraZeneca Vaccine. Brussels has encouraged European Union member states to act on a new European Medicines Agency opinion that the benefits of the Oxford-AstraZeneca COVID vaccine outweigh the risk of blood clots in all adult age groups. The European Commissioner for Health, Stella Kyriakides, emphasized the vaccine's importance as part of the European Union's strategy despite months of controversy following the latest conclusions from the European Medicines Agency, EMA. In reference to member states who have resumed use of the vaccine in recent days following the discovery of blood clots as a very rare side effect, Stella Kyriakides said she welcomed the fact that they had reflected on the latest evidence. She has been lobbying European capitals to take a coordinated position on the use of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine to rebuild public confidence. Last week, however, Denmark became the first European Union member state to abandon the Oxford-AstraZeneca jab. It is clear the overall benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine is preventing COVID-19 outweighs the risk of very rare and unusual side effects, Kyriakides said in a statement. The Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine is an important part of our vaccine portfolio. It is an effective vaccine that protects from severe disease and death in the European Union and also globally. The basis for safe vaccination campaigns and the European Union vaccine strategy is pharmacovigilance. The basis for successful vaccination campaigns is citizens' trust. Trust requires science, clarity, and coherence. Let's ensure that we provide this to our citizens. Following a request by the Commission for further investigation of the vaccine's risk profile, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, said on Friday that its benefits outweigh the risks for all age groups and that the benefits of the vaccine increased with age and the level of infection. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, declined to update the number of cases of blood clots linked to low platelets in people given the Oxford-AstraZeneca jab, saying it wanted to step away from a regular count. Instead, it has published a series of graphs demonstrating the risk of hospitalization, intensive care admission, or death from COVID against the risk of blood clots for different age groups in low, medium, and high infection rate settings. In the youngest age groups, 20 to 29-year-olds and 30 to 39-year-olds, where infection rates are low, the risk of blood clots is higher than the risk of intensive care admission and death. But those people are still at higher risk of hospital admission. For all age group categories, benefits occur in some scenarios, said Dr. Peter Arlett, the European Medicine Agency's head of pharmacovigilance. Dr. Peter Arlett stressed that the favorable effects of vaccination compared with the very rare effects of blood clots increase with age and infection rate. It would be up to European member states to decide whether to introduce age restrictions on the use of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. Britain has opted to allow anyone under the age of 30 to choose to have an alternative to the Oxford-AstraZeneca jab. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, does not yet have enough data on the gender of those suffering blood clots with low platelets, officials said. That is still being collected in some countries.